Well, welcome everybody. We're starting session two. There's some people here I see who aren't usually here. That's great. And then we're missing a few people, but maybe more people will show up. I want to start with a couple of practical issues, and then we'll go into the reading. First of all, I want to remind you that we are going to be taking a break after week three. So we'll do 3 weeks. This is week one, and then there'll be a week off. And the only reason for that is that that is my schedule. I'll be out of town that week, and it was just easier. So we'll do 3 weeks, 1 week off, and then 3 weeks on, and that will be the whole six-week session. You'll be reminded of that in various ways, but I wanted to get you thinking about it right now. On the other hand, especially for those of you in the United States, the weekend after that, the meeting is actually December 1st. That's the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. So a lot of people in this country make plans for the whole Thanksgiving weekend. So I'll understand if you can't be there live, but perhaps if you plan carefully, you can. Okay, the next thing is mostly involves the teacher training part of the program. I have an email, a memo that I will send around attached to an email that goes into the details of how the teacher training program is going to work. So we'll really get that moving now. And what I'm going to do is send it around in the next day or two to everybody who's enrolled in the teacher training and ask for feedback. So it won't be officially in effect until I get the feedback, but I think I'll ask for it by next Friday or so, so that we can really get it going after that. So you can look for that, those of you in the teacher training program. One of the things in the teacher training program is that everybody who's in that program should be doing all of the weekly assignments. But the notes from Kathleen and I lost my train of thought. Anybody who wants to regularly hand in assignments, just send in the next assignment, and you remember the way we do that is it's just by sending it in to assignments@creativeinquiry.org. Just send it in, and by that, in doing that, we'll just put you on the list. Everybody is welcome to send in the assignments, but only the teacher trainees are expected, I hate to say required, but I will, are required to hand in the assignments. Anybody else who'd like to do that can. And if you hand in assignments, we're going to be assigning mentors to comment on your assignments, kind of be available as someone you can discuss these things with. That's part of the teacher training program. So that'll happen in the next week or so. Let's see. And the last practical thing is that I'm going to be traveling the next couple of days, so it probably won't be until Tuesday that I have the orientation for next week up. So it'll be a little bit later than usual, but I will plan on putting the recording of this conversation up as soon as we're finished. And it always takes a day or so because we have to send it to our webmaster. So that should be up if you want to listen to the recording again, or if somebody else that you know missed the live conversation wants to listen. That should be up fairly soon. Okay, those are my practical issues. Let me remind people, and I think Kathleen was doing some of this before I joined the call, but those of you who are attending this call via your computer can use the chat box on the lower right of the screen. And a lot of people seem to prefer that as a way of making comments. But you're also welcome, either whether you're here on by phone or by computer, to speak up. But as Kathleen notes in the chat box, you have been muted. This is for people on the computer, I guess. I'm not quite sure how that works. If you're not on the computer, if you're on a phone and you want to unmute yourself, I don't know how to do that. Kathleen, maybe you know, because I see Eliana and Hayward, for instance, are on the phone. How could they speak? So I'll leave that up to you. Maybe you can. They know how to do it. Okay. Kathleen says they already know how to do it. I'm the guy who doesn't know. Okay. Very good. That's all the practical stuff. So let's start talking about TSK, about the first chapter of the first book. So in a way, it's always exciting to return to the first chapter of the first book, because this is where it all began, you could say. My own experience with TSK is that over the years, because I've been editor for all of the other TSK books, but not this one, I tend to work more with the later books. But as I've said to people before, people who started with this book really think of this as the book. Everything else is commentary. And that's fine. And it's a wonderful book, a wonderful resource. And every time I return to it, it's exciting for me, because there's... As with everything in TSK, there's always something new wherever you look. But this really is, as Ron says, this is the root text. That looking at the chat comment here, yes, it's absolutely the root text. And the first sentence of this first chapter, among people who are real TSK fans, is a very well-known chapter sentence. But I want to spend some time looking at it. The sentence says, whatever we do, wherever we go, whatever happens on this crowded surface of interactions constituting our world, there is also the sky. Actually, I want to comment more on the rest of the paragraph. The sky is perhaps the simplest example of space, but it is a very important symbol as well. No matter how tangled, crowded, and intense our activities might be, the sky is present too, directly above everything. And it goes on to say that the sky could be thought of as a local representative of space. So that's actually what I want to focus on, that idea, because it seems to me that it has several levels. When you say the sky is the local representative of space, what are you saying? What are you talking about? So the first thing to say is, I think the sort of obvious meaning of that is that space, if you consider it as a whole, the space of the universe, we're talking physical space here, and we'll get into that later, that's probably infinite, or at least very, very, very big. But locally, that space shows up as sky. If you imagine starting from the surface of the Earth and rising up through the atmosphere, gradually the atmosphere, the air thins out, and instead of this nice blue sky that we like to normally think of when we think of the sky, instead of that, the sky starts to turn black, and after a while, we're in outer space. Inner space is this what surrounds the Earth, and that's our local representative, and outer space is what happens once you get past that. So that's one way of thinking about it. Space as a whole includes or makes room for the entire physical universe, the galaxies and the stars in the galaxies and cosmic dust and all of that. But locally, the only space we have contact with, thinking of that aspect of space, we have contact with the sky. And, you could say, a little bit hard to say it the right way, we don't even usually have contact with the sky. We have contact with the air right just in the few feet above the surface of the Earth. But above that is the sky. So the sky is present as a local representative of this infinity of space. Okay. And that's a very simple way to understand it, because that's how we've learned to think about space. You know, we think about space as being the sorry, I'm getting distracted today by the chats, but don't please keep making comments on the chat in the chat box. That's fine. We think about space as this neutral, blank, astronomical kind of space, and it just so happens that in this particular location, that neutral space is occupied by the Earth, and it just so happens that the Earth is occupied by us. But those are kind of special cases. We think of space as this absolute, fundamentally uniform blank. And so it's natural to think about it that way. Michael's comment here is, the eyeball of the Earth looks out through the sky. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure I'd accept that, although it's a nice image. It works in some contexts. But of course, we're always looking, we're not looking out at the sky so much. Well, maybe that's fair to say. The sky is like, the sky is like our window to absolute space, if we think of absolute space in the sense that I just referred to. And that's one way of thinking about it. But, we also want to talk about other ways. The problem, of course, with, and Sudhi says that Michael's comment is playful and creative, and I agree it is. And I don't mean to discourage that kind of creativity when I say that's not the place I'd want to focus. But it is a great image. It really is. Some of you may know that painting by Magritte, which shows an eye, and the eye, instead of being filled with the cornea, is filled with the sky. That's the eyeball of the Earth. It's a nice image. But when we think of space that way, if we say space is the local representative, we're committing ourselves to a version of space, this version of space in which space is nothing, it's empty, it's absolutely uniform, and so on. And one of our big problems as in our time and space, in this moment that we occupy, is exactly that we think of space in that way, because space considered that way is also inherently meaningless. If you think of space as absolute, as uniform, it's space in which our existence at this particular moment seems to be kind of arbitrary and accidental. And the great expression of that in Western culture, the one that I know anyway and always think of in this context, is by Pascal, who was writing in the 17th century, I believe, and who wrote about this absolute space. He said something like, the vast silence of infinite space terrifies me. It terrified him. Why? Well, because it meant nothing. It makes us insignificant. So if we think about the sky as a representative of that absolute space, it's not going to be very liberating. I mean, it makes sense, and it's not a bad thing, but it's not going to take us where we want to go. There are other aspects. Caroline makes a comment here saying, the sky can be an accessible way to access limitlessness. And that, I think, is much more really what Rinpoche is pointing to here. The whole focus in TSK is always on, you could say, our experience. That's a little bit limiting way to say it. But nonetheless, it's on, what is space for us? How do we engage space? How do we How does it limit us? How does it free us? It's always a question, because we are so centered on our own experience, it's always a question of how does a particular understanding of space or a particular experience of space change our world. So that gets, I'm anticipating the discussion of focal settings, which comes just in the next page of this chapter. We'll talk about that in just a bit. Sudhi says in this context, it's an unknown that from the first level seems scary. That's right. In our ordinary way, you might call that first level. We talked a little about the three levels of space in the last session in class six, and I'm not sure I'd exactly call that first level, but definitely it's our ordinary understanding. Our ordinary understanding of space, in the sense that it just goes on forever, and our being here in this moment, there's no particular way to explain that. Yes, that's scary, that's terrifying. And it's also, in a funny sense, limiting, because, yes, space is infinite, and in that sense, our view is limitless, which is what Caroline was saying. But it's also limiting in the sense that we've already defined space as something that has no meaning. It just goes on forever and ever for no particular reason. And here we are, these little people on this little planet around a medium-sized sun in one galaxy. Doesn't make any sense at all. So that particular approach to space can be scary, can be limiting, even though it's also allowing, it does at least suggest the possibility that space is limitless. But we'd like to find a different way of investigating or appreciating, really, what that means. So, okay. Let's take a look at the other meanings of this statement or this paragraph where Rinpoche describes the sky. So he says, no matter how tangled, crowded, and intense our activities might be, the sky is present too. Right? And it's a symbol, he says. It's a symbol of what? Well, I think this gets to where what Caroline says, it's a symbol of the limitlessness or limitlessness. It's a symbol of the possibility of freeing ourselves from our ordinary concerns, our ordinary way of looking, our ordinary way of understanding ourselves and our possibilities. It's if you think about what it means to be a human being, there's something very funny about it that we maybe don't think about that often, which is here we are on the surface of the earth, and we understand completely that even just thinking about the atmosphere and the sky, that it goes up for miles and miles and miles and miles, but we spend 99.9% of our lives just in this little 6-foot realm, at the very bottom of this whole range of space. And that's where everything happens that concerns us. That's where we're happy and unhappy. That's where we grasp for things and where we try to avoid things. That's where we interact with people. And we get caught up in all sorts of things, and it's all going on just on a few feet, miles and miles and miles of sky or the space of the atmosphere. And for the most part, we never engage it. So if we were aware of the sky as a symbol, as he says, of the possibility of going beyond our ordinary concerns, that in itself could be very liberating. So, many years ago, Steve Randall, whom some of you know, I remember was very excited about a study he had read about or heard about, which had to do with school children. And I remember that it was school children in an inner city school, so they were from a poor neighborhood in Philadelphia. And somebody had the idea of taking them out during recess, you know, on a break from classes. And instead of playing, they had them lie down on the ground and look up at the sky. Whoever that is needs to be muted, but it's fine. Go ahead. Had the idea of looking down, looking up at the sky. And that's all they did. They just had them do that for a certain amount of time. And I don't know how long, probably not too long, since these were squirmy little kids, right? And they found that just doing that had a measurable impact on how they performed in school, how they got along with other people. They were able to focus better. They were more open to experience just by looking at the sky. And that's, I think, really at the heart of what Rinpoche has in mind here when he says, above us, wherever we go, whatever we do, this crowded surface of interactions, above us is the sky. Above us is this possibility of a more free, a more open, a more relaxed way of engaging the world. When I looked at, I tried to do a little research online to see if I could find that study that I was just talking about. And in fact, I couldn't. But I did find a reference to a song that a lot of people will know was popular back in the, I don't know, the 30s or 40s before my time, that starts off in the blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see. And that's, in a way, the sense. You know, I think that song may, you know, partly that has to do with sunlight. I mean, you know, a blue sky, in a blue sky, you have this cheery sun shining. And that's a part of what's going on. But it's also right that the very presence of blue sky has something valuable for us. Mm-hmm. Was there a question? Somebody speaking up? Nope. Okay. There's another dimension. I think I'm taking a little too long with this, so let me try to move along. He also talks about, in the second paragraph, he's talking about the sky, and he says, you can contemplate the sky in its vastness, its openness, and its depth. And again, this is pointing toward freedom. And I just want to point out there's the vastness of the sky. So it's like if you do lie down on the ground and look up at the sky, it's everywhere, right? There's nothing... nothing left, nothing, you know, the sky fills the horizon completely. But there's also the depth and that, you know, the sense that the sky extends out forever. And that possibility is there. Although you don't want it to go in the direction we were talking about before about the sky as meaningless. No, it's more whatever the sky may allow for. Let's say the sky gives us a sense of freedom, of not being so caught up in our ordinary concerns. Well, that possibility in itself has infinite depth, and that's another way to look. So Ron points out there's another nice song about the sky by the Allman Brothers called Blue Sky, so I invite you to look that up. And then Michael says, perhaps to engage the intimate opening allowed by the sky, we need a way of looking in, as in the tanka behind Jack. That's a mandala tanka, right? Allowing a way of looking that unfolds, integrates, and is full of doorways. Well, that's very nice. If the sky only opens outward, then the risk is... And if that means that it moves away from us, you know, here we are at the center, and in our culture we think of ourselves as the center of everything that's meaningful. Without us, the world is not meaningful. You know, of course, people who have a religious perspective see it differently, but this is a very fundamental truth in our culture. If looking out at the sky means moving away from the source of meaning, then there's no way in. But if there's a way in which the sky can itself be meaningful, and that has to do with the question of how space and knowledge relate to each other, which we'll look at, then that's very different. I think that's what Michael's comment is pointing towards. Okay. There is another sense of the sky. And Rinpoche points to this, and it goes in really, I think, just the opposite direction. And it's good to recognize that even in these first two paragraphs, Rinpoche's bringing up both points. Let me go back for a moment since it relates to what I just said. Caroline asks, what if the external sky reflects an internal sky? Yeah, so that internal openness or freedom. We're actually going to do a practice in a couple of minutes that relates to that. Okay, but I want to point toward the other side. And this is in the second paragraph, he says, although it can be contemplated in its vastness, openness, and depth, that's what we were just looking at, even the sky is related to as a boundary, an enclosing spherical surface. And then he says, you know, maybe not such a problem, because in doing that, we're also reminded then of the vastness and depth of outer space, what we call outer space. You know, the larger open spaces of the solar system, galaxy, and universe. But I want to focus for just a moment on this notion that the notion of space that we ordinarily operate with always has to do with boundaries. You know, we're always naming things, identifying things, and even the sky, and this is the point that Rinpoche is making here, is that it's an enclosing spherical surface. So we have this sense that we inhabit a world, and the world carries its atmosphere with us, with it, and the atmosphere is the sky. And that's it. That's the only place we can inhabit. If we were somehow suddenly thrust out of that little marble bowling ball that we call the Earth, we'd die, right, instantly. So we establish this limit. This is the world. This is the place where I can be. This is the world, the place that I can exist. And in that sense, when you talk about the sky as a local representative, it points out that, or it's a way of pointing out, that the sky is, or that wherever we are, we're always creating a kind of a local circumstance, a local setting, and we depend on that, and we take our identity from it. So even talking about the sky, there is this other dimension, although that's not the main focus of what Rinpoche is saying here, but it's important to recognize it, I think, because that's our ordinary space, our ordinary understanding. And that kind of, it's not exactly a tension, but that those two possibilities are always present and available. So Philip says here, we've been taught that we live in our bodies within a few feet of the atmosphere below the sky. So that's what I was saying, just parroting back what I've been taught. It's true. But aren't we free to live supposing, thinking, feeling, connecting with the idea or truth that we are a part of the whole, whatever it is, limitless, the universe, etc., and that our bodies are just the tiny centers of our beings? Yes, I think absolutely. So, and that is one way, a very important way of approaching space in the TSK vision. You know, we want, the whole point is, so you wrote here, Philip, aren't we free to live supposing, thinking, feeling this way? And yes, but in order to do that, we need to exercise the quality of imagination, imagining that it could all be different, you know, that there are other possibilities. So I think that's a very nice statement of what's possible with TSK, and especially in particular with the understanding of space in TSK. And in fact, you know, part of what I think is really interesting and important about this opening discussion about the sky is when Rinpoche says that we are looking at the sky as a symbol. It's still in the first paragraph. He says the sky is perhaps the simplest example of space, but it's a very important symbol as well. Now, we could spend some time trying to figure out what a symbol is. I don't really want to do that. I just want to take it in kind of a simple way, the sense of a symbol. What I want to say about symbols, or about this particular symbol, the sky as a symbol, is that a symbol invites us to look beyond what appears on the surface. You know, to take the symbol as a symbol of something that goes deeper or goes beyond. And that's what Rinpoche is doing here. He's taking the sky as a symbol of the possibility of going beyond this, you know, ourselves as the tiny center of our being, as Philip just said or wrote. And the reason I want to call attention to that is because so much of the TSK inquiry has to do exactly with that. You know, we go about our lives just looking at our ordinary experience, but anything in our lives, any moment in our experience, can be a symbol that points beyond itself to something deeper or richer or even just different. You know? Some other possibility. And the whole process of TSK inquiry has a lot to do with the symbolic in that sense, with the possibility, you know, wherever we look, we can ask questions and we can look for a kind of meaning or a realm of possibility that is ordinarily, you know, we ordinarily don't think about it all. So when you say the sky is a symbol and you say, well, is that in itself, that statement, let's take that statement as a symbol of what's possible in the TSK vision. It's a symbol of the possibility that we can question everything, that we can consider everything, that we can look where we don't usually look. So, you know, little children are very interested in the sky. They're very interested in everything. But, you know, the sort of typical question we think of children asking when they start asking questions is, why is the sky blue? You know, and we may or may not have an answer to that question. But what we don't ordinarily have is a way of asking that question ourselves or some related question, looking at the sky and saying, what does it mean? I mean, just go back to the very first statement. What does it mean that even while I'm caught up in my concerns and my entanglements, above me is the sky? Is that an open invitation to move towards something limitless, or an open invitation to connect with the whole? Those are the kinds of questions that TSK invites us to explore, and it's not, we don't need the TSK books for that, but we very often seem to need something because for two reasons. One is we just get caught up in those ordinary entanglements and we need someone to get our attention to say there's more going on than that. And second, the TSK books help because what Rinpoche is trying to do in the TSK vision is look at the fundamental elements of our being, which he identifies here as in the vision as time and space and knowledge. And even if we're awake to the possibility of exploration, of looking at our world symbolically, let's say, looking for meaning, looking for something deeper, we may need some guidance in where to look. We may not have thought to ask in a deep enough way. TSK, I think, is always trying to give us a deeper way of looking, a deeper kind of inquiry. And not just looking, of course, in the sense of looking at something outside us, but a deeper way of experiencing. So Sudhi quotes something that I think is not from this reading, but is, you know, she's pointing to as relevant. She says, "I love this phrase. By choosing the openness of space and the dynamic of time, knowledge returns to the prior." So the prior is a term, that's why I can tell this isn't from this reading. It's not used in this book, the word the prior, I don't think. If I'm wrong, correct me. So what is the prior? Well, the prior, if you were putting it in the language of this first chapter, is prior to all this tangling up and being crowded and being intense, prior to inhabiting a particular world, you know, prior to being pushed down by gravity to the surface of the earth with a kind of tendency not to look up and experience the sky, prior to all of that, we can embark on a journey that isn't connected to that. So, yeah, it's a great quote. And I'll just repeat that part of it. By choosing the openness of space and the dynamic of time, knowledge returns to the prior, a journey that sets no goal other than to embody space and time directly. Okay, so what I want to do is, as a practice, just a simple practice, and it's very much related to this. You can imagine, of course, by the way, that there's all sorts of other interesting things to say in this chapter, and maybe I will address some of them in the orientation, but I think it's good for us to focus, and it's always good to remember how much is going on in every sentence, every paragraph of the TSK book. So I want to do a practice, you know, just for a couple of minutes now, that relates to this, and the practice really has to do with blue sky. As most of you know, there is an exercise in the first TSK book which involves actually going out and finding a place where you can make a more intimate connection with the sky. It's called a mountain retreat, but most people just call it the big sky practice. But you can also do that internally, and that's what I'd like you to do right now. We'll just do this for a couple of minutes, and then give people a little chance to comment on it. And that is, close your eyes and imagine that you're floating in the blue sky. You may have a little bit of a sense of that if you've been in a plane, you break through the clouds on your way up, and now there's just blue sky everywhere. Or you may have other things you can think of. But just imagine that you're floating in the sky and that you're breathing in sky as you breathe and then breathing it out too. As you breathe, just breathing in blue sky and let it sort of fill your whole body. Let your body dissolve into that. So it's just a way of connecting with this possibility, which we usually do not connect with, and connecting with it as a symbol of, let's say, the freedom that is available to us when we can disentangle ourselves from our ordinary concerns. So just for a couple of minutes now, breathing in, floating in sky, breathing in blue sky, letting that be. Okay. So I will give people a chance to make some comments on that. If anybody wants to speak up, that's fine. Or if you want to write something, I look forward to what your experience is, to hearing about what your experience is. Doing this practice is a little bit like the last phrase in the quote that Sudhi put up. It's undertaking a journey that sets no goal. You could say it's undertaking a journey that goes nowhere. To enter space and to let space enter us is a kind of a stillness that offers a different aliveness. And it may be that we have some resistance to doing that. Because ordinarily, you know, we're caught up with our concerns. And the very nature of a concern is that it concerns us. And so, you know, there's a tendency if we say, no, let go of it, just breathe in the sky. There's a voice that speaks up that says, No, you know, I have other things to do, important things to do. So this practice is sort of a challenge to all of that. So let's see. Karen says, I love it. I love doing this practice. I think so much ease. Yeah, exactly. So this is actually very much doing the practice that those little kids lying down in the playground in Philadelphia many years ago. I wonder what they're doing now, that they were doing. You know, we're giving ourselves the chance to do that. And that opportunity, of course, is always there. Okay, here's a couple of others. Dan writes, and Dan, by the way, you did this privately. The first one you did privately, you didn't, which I'm sure wasn't your intention, but I'm going to read it anyway, so it doesn't matter. I have the sense of my body, or just the body. Not necessarily my body, right? Dissolving into the space of the sky so that the boundaries between body and sky dissolve. And it's one unified space experiencing itself. Okay, so that's nicely described. What's always interesting and important in these practices, and it's kind of amazing, isn't it, that just a couple of minutes gives you some sense, of course. You know, people come with some experience, perhaps, in studying this vision. But still, it doesn't take too much to recognize that there are other possibilities. And so what's important in these experiences is exactly that another possibility opens. The exact content isn't as important, but it can lead us in certain directions, which is great. I see. Okay, Dan did figure out that he'd done it privately and repeated it. Caroline, in the meantime, said, this has something of the quality of nighttime dreams of flying. Also noticed that some parts of my body have more affinity with sky than others, notably the head. Well, that's very interesting. You know, the head always, for people who do meditation in particular, the head is always the bad guy. We're always talking about how important it is to open the heart. And we do talk about, I mean, I'm thinking now of the books that Rinpoche has written about meditation and related practices. And he says you have to balance the head and the heart. But generally people tend to say, oh, I spend too much time in my head. You know, I need to make more contact with my body and to really let the heart be at the center. And there's valid reasons for saying that. But it's nice to balance that a little bit, and so maybe that's right. And, you know, maybe it's mostly for you, Caroline, but maybe it's also for other people. The head, you know, I've used the word occasionally, and Rinpoche certainly uses it in the TSK books, the word imagination. You need to be able to open up other possibilities to explore. And the sky is a kind of a local representative, a symbol of those possibilities. Well, the head is somehow seems to be very connected with the ability to imagine. So let's give it a little credit. I like that. Okay, Philip says, the sound of birds, dogs, people talking in the street, and traffic became very, very loud and seemed to be swirling about and rushing around the whole sky and circling the world. Okay, that's nice. Yeah, the sky, the sky doesn't necessarily mean stillness, or it certainly doesn't mean that you go somewhere else. So maybe it's really important that Rinpoche says, you know, we're busy doing what we do in our ordinary world, and above us is the sky. And it's not necessarily the case that we would want to escape into the sky, but maybe we want to bring the sky into our world. And that Philip has described something like that. That's nice. Sudhi says, it relies, okay, she's quoting from again, it relies, maybe the TSK vision, relies on imagination, on inspiration and imagination as vehicles. How sad that I cannot remember this always. Well, yeah. You know, whatever our experience, and again, this is this sort of twofold. No matter what's going on in our world, above us is the sky. And no matter how caught up we are, or, you know, how away we are from imagination, and from the aliveness of awareness and knowingness, that being far away from is also a manifestation of knowingness. It's just managed to tie itself up in a tight enough knot so that we have a very hard time noticing. Let's see. And Ron says, a creative bodily fabrication, a restorying, a nice word, and I think maybe deliberately connected to restoring, a restoring of embodiment. If we are to fabricate, it might as well be in the direction of openness, likeness, and creativity. And I think that relates very much to what Sudhi just said. And I invite you, by the way, in these comments, these are very nice comments, but I invite you to comment on what other people say. You know, it tends to be sort of a back and forth, me and the other guy, the one who's just said something. People, it's great if you comment on each other's stuff too. But so I think what Sudhi and Ron say are kind of like two sides of the coin. Okay. Brigitte says, I had to imagine the sky is charged, alive, sparkling. Otherwise, I would have a problem to let go. So I think you're saying if the sky were just kind of a passive, you know, it could easily turn into a nothing at all, you know, our ordinary understanding of space. That's a possibility. So the blueness, maybe that's one reason the blue is so important, because the blue itself is alive. Or maybe, as you say, it has to be sparkling. That's nice. And Bruce says, the experience of the open blue sky drawn in and exhaled into vastness has a deeply nourishing and peaceful quality. But I also felt a very subtle edge of anxiety, body and ego feeling potentially endangered and overwhelmed by limitlessness and boundarylessness. This stood out as the transformative edge of the practice for me. What, if anything, is lost when we open to limitlessness? So that also goes back, I think, though there is a nice discussion, even if I'm making the links a little bit, between what Sudhi said and what Ron said and what you're saying here, Bruce. Does opening to the limitless mean letting go of our ordinary concerns, or is there a way to bring the two together? Those are really good questions to explore, to investigate. And Ron, I think, is making the same, or is seconding what Bruce says, that you could fall into a kind of blankness. And that, too, turns on what Brigitte says. So, yes, I think the experiences that people have here help, you know, they help open up what it means. This blue sky possibility in every dimension. So keep working with that. I'm going to give you a walk-around practice. I decided I'd call them walkabout practices, which is different. But, of course, this is the kind of practice that's always open and available. And the TSK vision in general is always open and available.